On behalf of the Yeshiva University Student Medical Ethics Society, I would like to welcome all of you to tonight's lecture on Do Not Resuscitate Orders, DNR, in Halakha. It's exciting to see the familiar faces that have joined us in past events, and we'd like to welcome all those attending their first event with us. Please be sure to sign up on our email list so that you can keep posted on the events that, on our future events. That should be going around, and it'll also be available at the end of the lecture. The Student Medical Ethics Society at Yeshiva University is a student-run organization with the goal of promoting education and awareness about medical ethics issues, especially as they relate to halakha and Torah values. The Society strives to make Yeshiva University a global center for Jewish medical ethics, which will serve as an educational resource for laymen, rabbis, patients, doctors, and other health professionals. The questions raised by Do Not Resuscitate orders pose difficult challenges to all parties involved in making end-of-life decisions. Doctors, nurses, patients, and their families are often asked to make these decisions under dire circumstances and great stress. By learning about the relevant ethical and halakhic issues before they arise in real-world situations, we can be better prepared to deal with these difficult decisions in a productive and ethical manner. As ethically responsible individuals and Torah-guided Jews, it's our duty to seek a Torah perspective and to utilize that perspective to guide us in our behavior as beneficiaries of advancing medical technology. We are very excited to have this opportunity to learn together about such a vital issue in both the Jewish community and society at large. Our speaker tonight brings with him the proper values, Torah knowledge, and medical expertise necessary to provide us with the tools needed to examine the issues that are relevant to DNR. Rabbi Dr. Howard Abdel is a board-certified pediatric cardiologist at Columbia University Medical Center. He received his medical degree from State University of New York, downstate, in 1989, and completed his residency at Schneider Children's Hospital. He also completed a fellowship at the Babies and Children's Hospital of Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center and specializes in congenital heart disease. Rabbi Dr. Abdel received his rabbinic ordination from Reitz in 2003. Over the past few years, Rabbi Dr. Abdel has been a Makid Shir at Yeshivot Mevaseret and Torah Shraga in Israel and currently teaches Talmud at Yeshiva University's MTA High School. He has also taught bioethics courses at Gris Kollel in Yerushalayim and Lander College. He also currently teaches a class in Hilchot Shabbat as it relates to physicians at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. I would personally like to extend my gratitude to the executive board of the Medical Ethics Society for putting together this event. The Student Medical Ethics Society would also like to thank the Center of the Jewish Future of the Student Organization of Yeshiva and the Torah Activities Council for sponsoring tonight's event. We'd also like to thank Dr. Abdel for taking time out of his busy schedule to teach us this evening. Please note that cell phones should be turned off and that there will be an opportunity for Dr. Abdel to address questions at the end of the program. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Howard Abdel.
Good evening. I'd like to thank the organizers of the event for giving me the opportunity to speak to everybody and for putting together such a wonderful event. It's really an incredible organization. Before we begin, I just wanted to point out the handouts have page 2 on the end. So, page 2 is in the back of the handout. Eschatai ani maskir hayom. I have to admit that the topic of DNR, not resuscitating, is not among my favorite topics. And truthfully, I'm not really embarrassed to admit that. I think that it's important to emphasize that truthfully, halachic people, in the words of Rav Soloveitchik, who emphasized this many times, are really people who focus on life. And by way of hakdama, before I start to talk about different shitot with varying degrees, l'kula u'l'chumra, of withholding and withdrawing life-sustaining treatments, I wanted to share with you something that I think is an important backdrop to the entire conversation. And as a pediatric cardiologist, probably the last thing I think about on a daily basis is not resuscitate. There's nothing more exciting, satisfying, exhilarating than to experience the resuscitation of an individual who, Rahman al-Islam, is on the brink of death. It's an indescribable feeling to successfully resuscitate such an individual. I remember the first such episode I was involved in as a fellow in cardiology. It was at a time when I was learning how much less I knew than I thought I knew about cardiology. And there was this young boy about 6 or 7 years old who had a particular cardiac defect. It was the type of defect that actually is fairly routinely repaired. And that was the attitude of the surgeon as he spoke to the parents. And I remember this, you can imagine the scene, this is very typical. It was the child who was the apple of his parents' eye. They just adored him. He is a beautiful child. Gives away the engine a little bit. And the surgeon, in their typical, very confident, somewhat arrogant way, was telling the parents not to worry, it is a piece of cake, I could do it with my eyes closed. Actual statements that he made. This is going to be nothing, everything will be fine. The parents, of course, were not totally assuaged by that and were quite distraught until, Baruch Hashem, the surgery itself went very well. The defect was repaired. We were up in the ICU. Everybody's, you know, patting each other on the back. Great job. I told you nothing would be wrong. And the surgeon went home. And then the cardiology attending went home. And I was left there in the ICU because, as those in the medical profession know, it isn't us, I'll call myself this, old-timers that really get involved in a code in a cardiac arrest, but it's the house staff, it's the fellows and the residents. And there I was, fresh out of residency, a brand new cardiology fellow, and I was given the responsibility of taking care of all the patients, including this young man. I was quite reassured by the optimism of the surgeon, and I went on my way looking at all the other patients that I was taking care of, when suddenly I get called back, stat, arrest. This young child is having a cardiac arrest. I run over, and I start the resuscitation. CPR, you know, in the hospital you're at a certain advantage. It's not quite like you see on TV or in the movies out on the street. You have a whole team with you, you have medications, everything seemed to be going well. But there are always two objectives when you're involved in a cardiac arrest. Objective number one is keep the patient alive. Keep the circulation going. Maintain all the vital organs. Make sure there's oxygenation and circulation. That's half of the job. The second half is obviously to try to locate the underlying cause of the arrest and eliminate it. I was doing very well, if I say so, with part one. I thought we were maintaining blood pressure, heart rate, we were sustaining this child, we were keeping all his vital organs, including especially his brain, everything was being kept intact. But I was beginning to really sweat, as I am right now, over the fact that I could not discover the underlying cause of the problem. Part of it was probably due to my inexperience at the time. But we were 15 to 20 minutes into this arrest, and fortunately, Mehmet Oz came by. Anybody here familiar with Dr. Mehmet Oz? He's getting pretty well known, right? He is a cardiothoracic surgeon at Columbia. He was on Oprah. He writes an article, a column in Reader's Digest. At that time, he was a few years ahead of me training to be a cardiothoracic surgeon. So he comes by and he sees me in the middle of all this. And he says, Howie, how's everything going? That was very typical style of Mehmet. I said, well, you know, fine. And I explained to him my dilemma. So he said, well, did you open the chest? I said, well, what he's thinking is, Maybe there's a pocket of fluid around the heart that's compressing it, and that's what's causing the problem. So being the brilliant two-week fellow that I was, I said, well, you know, I have chest tubes in, and I think they're definitely flowing. I don't think it's an issue of tamponade. I don't think it's an issue like what you're thinking. So he looks at me, and without batting an eyelash, just shoves me out of the way, goes over to the boy, opens up his chest, and outpours the fluid that I thought wasn't there, and immediately full recovery to the boy, Baruch Hashem, stabilized completely. And of course, Mehmet got all the glory. The surgeons usually do. But I nevertheless, especially now in retrospect, felt that I had accomplished something very significant. And that's really what I want to emphasize with this story. I had sustained life. Irrespective of the outcome, in this case, it was Baruch Hashem, a great outcome. The boy did great. But I realized that even though I had only accomplished half my job in this arrest, I had accomplished something very significant. Something that is going to be the underlying sense of every shita that we will explore tonight. And that is the universal recognition by every posek that we discuss that every moment of life is precious, every moment of life is filled with kedusha. And there is no shita that thinks otherwise. Having said that, I want to start with page one of the handout. Person having Rahman al-Mutsan cardiac arrest in the 1950s would likely not have been as fortunate as the young man I just described. At that time, there was no such thing as CPR. If a person had an arrest, the only options were quite brutal to some degree, opening the chest and direct cardiac massage. So it's no surprise that in 1960, when this article, and this is from the actual article, appeared, it was very exciting to the entire medical community. You could just tell the excitement by the style of writing of this article. I don't think this would get through too many peer-reviewed articles in our time. It almost sounds like an advertisement. The use of this technique on 20 patients has given an overall permanent survival rate of 70%. Anyone, anywhere can now initiate cardiac resuscitative procedures. All that is needed are two hands. It's like, come buy one. It's an incredible article. And the excitement caught on, and the truth is, you know, you quote a success rate of 70%, that's quite impressive. The truth is, even in-hospital arrests, in our time, the data is not quite that optimistic. The truth is, in adult studies, it ranges anywhere between 5 and maybe 35%, with an average of about 15% survival. And in the pediatric population, a little higher, up to 50%. Nevertheless, it was a landmark event and was appreciated throughout the world. And to this day, closed chest cardiac massage continues to be the first line at any unfortunate event of arrest. But it wasn't too long before the article that you'll see on the bottom of the page, another trend emerged. What people began to realize in the medical community, in families, was that despite the fact that we had this great method of resuscitation, there were times and patients where many in the medical community felt resuscitation was inappropriate and not necessarily in the best interest of the patient. And so in 1976, we have this New England Journal of Medicine formalizing the idea that DNR, do not resuscitate orders, should be considered a regular part of a patient's care. And if you look at page 2, which is now, I think, the last page in the handout, what exactly is DNR? What exactly is do not resuscitate? In the simplest sense, it means that medical professionals will not perform CPR. They will not administer chest compressions, insert artificial airways, resuscitative drugs, defibrillate, cardiovert, initiate any type of resuscitative IV, or initiate cardiac monitoring. That is the simplest form of a DNR. Obviously, there are more complex forms that we will also be discussing, where other forms of therapy also can be withheld. In what setting would a DNR order of any type be considered? So there's really two categories that have to be looked at always as separate categories. One, and they're depicted below on page 2, one is the terminal patient. A patient who has been conclusively decided there is no possibility of a cure. The disease from which they suffer now will be the disease that will end their life. This has no age barrier, unfortunately. This is a dilemma that one encounters from infancy to old age. Generally, this type of individual is experiencing great suffering and pain. That's one setting where DNR's goal, to quote the article, is to allow for dying with dignity and without pain or distress. There is, however, a second group. This group was recently, a couple of years ago, made quite popular and known, persistent vegetative state. These are patients who presumably, although there is some argument, do not feel pain. Along with the group of patients that have this condition of being in a persistent vegetative state, which for those who don't know means they have no cognition. They have brainstem function, and that therefore by all definitions of death, they are alive. By halachic definitions, I should say. Yet, to the medical community and to many families, it is a group of people, to quote, where the inappropriateness of persisting with treatment which leaves the surviving patient with a useless life. It's a very, very dangerous expression. But that is the sense, that to maintain such a patient is maintaining somebody with a useless life. Along with the persistent vegetative patients are frail, elderly patients with varying degrees of dementia. They are also sort of lumped into this category. They are not necessarily suffering any physical pain, although often they are, but they're in a category where they're considered to have possibly a useless life. These issues of dying with dignity, dying without pain, the inappropriateness of sustaining a useless life, caught on very quickly in the medical community. I would say, although I never did a study, anecdotally my own experience is, in meeting many doctors, it is the norm amongst the medical community to be very comfortable with DNRs being more than appropriate in these two settings. In fact, at times, there is a little too much enthusiasm. And I want to just quickly show you, it's page 10, towards the back of the handout. It would have been the last page, but now it's probably the second to last page. Those of you in the medical community will not be surprised by this, but some of you who are not might be. This is from a conference at our medical school, given by one of the house officers. He gave the following case presentation of a 54-year-old woman who still harbored hope that another treatment would become available for her disease, and she wished that in the event of cardiac arrest, everything, absolutely everything, be done. She did not want a DNR, and she was very clear about it. An arrest occurred, and apparently the doctors taking care of her had a different idea. Epinephrine and atropine, those are cardiac arrest meds, were called for by the resident, but were secretly injected into the mattress instead of the patient's intravenous line. Sounds incredible, but believe me, it's being done with tremendous compassion and with good intention. Why is it that such a conflict exists. So among the conclusions of the author of this review, he felt that in these cases there is often discord between the expectations of the hospital staff and those of the patient and his or her family or healthcare proxy. That's what's the problem. They thought that people just had unrealistic expectations. You know, they watch shows on TV where the dramatic arrest always culminates in a victory. And that's the perception that people have in terms of the way things go. And then, of course, there's the miraculous cure that comes in. He felt that that asynchrony between the feelings of the medical community, their realistic feelings, and those of the people is what caused the conflict. The truth is, if we go back to page 3, there was a study that was done also at our institution, actually at the Institute of Psychiatry, that found a different explanation for different attitudes about DNR. The conclusion of this study was the belief that DNR decisions are morally wrong was predicted by certain religious practices, including near daily meditation, near daily thinking about God and the current practice of meditation, and by endorsement of the statement, my faith sometimes restricts my action. I'm probably guilty of that entire description. But what the authors of this study found was that people with this disposition were the most likely to have a problem with DNR. Now, in that study, I think it was 40% Catholic, 20% Protestant, 20% Jewish. Amongst the Jewish people in Colombia, there's a fairly large percentage that are Orthodox Jewish. But I began to wonder, and one can ask the following question, what is it about being religious that should necessarily change your attitude about DNR? Certainly, we recognize, as Kohelis says, Eis Lamos. People aren't meant to live forever. You don't have that type of mentality. And certainly, as the Sefer Hasidim points out, we have no desire to prolong anybody's suffering. We won't scream by the bedside of a gosis, of a terminal patient, to allow him to live and thereby continue suffering. And certainly, we believe in death with dignity. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rabbe, Amar Avua, Amar Krav, Yahavta L'Reicha Kamocha. You should love your neighbor as yourself. Bo lo misa yofe. What does that mean? What is pshat in love your neighbor as yourself? Well, one element is that you should make sure that he has a death with dignity. These are not foreign ideas. Where does the dichotomy come in? So, it'll be no surprise if you look at the next page. Comes down to the source of our decision making. Where is the source of decision making when we are confronted with the dilemma that we are describing? We're all confronting the same dilemma. General society as well as halachic society. There is a tension between two important values, the value of life and the value of ending human suffering. They're in conflict. How do you resolve such a conflict? So, Dr. Avram Steinberg, in his introduction to Encyclopedia Rifuit, gives the following nice, right-to-the-point differentiation of approach. A fundamental difference exists between Judaism and secular philosophical ethics in many facets of life. The basis, validity, and source of Jewish ethics, and he means Orthodox Jewish ethics, halachic ethics, is rooted in the belief in Hashem and his Torah, whereas the basis of secular ethics is primarily humanism and rational intellect. Further, he points out, the Torah and its precepts are continually interpreted and expanded by the rabbinic sages of each generation. They provide legal, ethical, and personal guidance to the Jewish people. So, no surprise. The source of our difficult ethical decisions must stem from Torah and Allah. Of course, there's a human element that has to come in as well. That's part of the halachic process. By design, the halachic process does not work like a computer. Poskim are as objective as they possibly can be, and there certainly is, within their processes, human input, again by design. Therefore, what we are about to begin is a discussion of six conclusions as to what the halacha has to say about these situations by six great Talmidei Chachamim. We're going to be looking at them from the most strict view, strict being defined as allowing the least amount of flexibility in terms of withholding and withdrawing therapy, and work our way down towards the most permissive view. And what you'll begin to see, and they're separated by page, is really these six opinions separated into two major groups. So for this, you need to take out that second handout. And for the sake of simplicity, although every posek, in order to paskin a shaila, in order to give a halachic response, is required to know the entire Torah, to really qualify. In order to appreciate the differences between these different shittos, I think you can hone in on really two, maybe three basic areas of Torah Sheba'al Peh. So I'd like to start with that. There is a very well-known Gemara in the Nedarim. And a well-known Gemara in Suvos that tells the famous story of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi on his last day. When Rabbi was about to die, his Talmid and his students were praying fervently to keep him alive. And while this was going on, Amsa de Rabbi, his handmaiden, was witnessing it. She was very, very close to him. And she was torn. She too would have loved for him to be alive. And yet, she saw that he was suffering greatly. And she came to the decision that it was in Rebbe's best interest not to stay alive. But the Talmidim of Rebbe would not listen to her. And they continued praying and keeping him alive. So to some degree, she took matters into her own hands. She created a distraction. They stopped for a moment, and Rebbe was gone. Just from that story alone, it's tough to draw too many conclusions. Do we listen to the handmaiden against all the great rabbis? Does she have a greater authority in matters of morality and Torah? It's very debatable. Although she was a great person, there are Gemaras that describe her greatness. For those interested, there's a Gemara in Moed Katan on Daf Yud Zayin that describes where her opinion was accepted as the halacha. Nevertheless, she was going up against many other rabbis. It was really the comments of the Ram, one of the medieval commentators, on the Gemara in the Nedarim that brings the story of Rebbe's handmaiden to the fore. And the Ram was commenting on a Gemara that mentioned and emphasized the significance of the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim, of visiting the sick. Why is it very, very important to be Mevakir Cholim, to visit sick people? Because a person who doesn't do it, a Mevakir Shel Rachamim lo sheyichya velo sheyamus. If you don't go to visit the sick, a place which is particularly advantageous for prayer, the Shechina is there over the bed of the sick individual. It's a great place to pray. Not only will you not be able to pray that the individual will live, but you lose the opportunity to pray that he died. Very strange statement. Various interpretations are given, but the one given by the Ran is the one we're most interested in. And the Ran says, this is the principle we learned from the handmaiden of Rebbe. Sometimes it's better for the individual to die. Sometimes you should pray that the individual die. We will see what the various approaches have to say about these two comments. I want to skip now the middle section and go right down to the bottom for the other very critical sugya. Here we have the comments from Or HaChaim, very well known, that Pikuach Nefesh is Docha all the Isurim in the Torah, except for the three cardinal sins. And even a Sofek Pikuach Nefesh, even if a doubtful threat to life, still, that takes precedence over all halachas. And then the Shulchan Aruch, based on the Gemara in Yuma, emphasizes this is true even in a terminal patient. Even in a patient who does not have long to live, right? Mitzayu merutzas she'eno yachal lefios ela lefisha, even such a patient, you can be mechalal Shabbos, you can override all the prohibitions of the Sabbath and not be concerned. Despite the fact that you know that that patient will not make it very long. And although some want to interpret that the issue is we're giving this person another chance to do a mitzvah, that's the famous sheet of the Meiri, the Chafetz Chaim, the author of the Mishnah Berurah, comes in and he says, don't think that that's really it. Just know it's the absolute sanctity and value of human life. That is the issue. And that is the reason every moment of life, no matter what the ultimate outcome, is more important than all the mitzvahs in the Torah. This comment is contrasted with the comments of the Rama that you'll find if you're on the page on the bottom left-hand corner. Also quite famous, where it's talking about an individual who is in a terminal condition called the Goses. And the halacha is that we consider any active ending of the life of the Goses the equivalent of murder of a full live person. So one cannot actively do anything to hasten his death. However, the Rama introduces what becomes really the hinge point for much of the discussion. If there is something present that is preventing the nefesh from leaving, kigon sheyesh samach la'osa bayis kol dofek. For example, if there is a noise outside the house where the person is lying, a knocking noise, somebody banging wood, chopping wood, o sheyesh melech alashono, or he has salt on his tongue, and these things are preventing the nefesh from going out, mutter la'asiro, you could actually take them away. You could stop the wood chopping, and you can stop, you can remove the salt. Why is this okay? She'ein bazemase, klal, eile shemesir hamoneya, hasaris hamoneya. You're removing the impediment to death. That is okay. There is an obvious contradiction between saying that every moment of life is absolutely precious and overrides all Yisurim, and at the same time saying that I'm allowed to remove something that is preventing somebody from dying. So if we turn the page now, we'll begin analyzing these basic sources, for they are going to be really the starting point and the major pivotal point for each of the opinions that we go through. The first opinion is of Rav Eliezer of Oldenburg, the Tzitz Eliezer. The Tzitz Eliezer, you'll hear momentarily, is at the extreme in terms of restricting any withholding or withdrawing of treatment for terminal patients. To begin with, he learns that the Ramah, was talking about a very unusual set of circumstances. When the Rama said that you can remove an impediment to death, he only meant in a case where the neshama was being prevented by some external force from leaving, but for all intents and purposes, the individual was actually no longer alive. It's incredible to read the description, but when Rav Waldenberg describes this interpretation, he is talking in the setting of a patient who reportedly no longer could breathe and no longer had a heartbeat, but was on a respirator. And he said, under those conditions, where there is no longer a heartbeat or an independent, confirmed independent ability to breathe, under those conditions and those conditions only, you can remove a respirator. And there was quite a reaction to this statement. Several doctors wrote in, and you'll see, if you look in the Tzitz Eliezer, there's a lot of back and forth on this issue. And finally, the Tzitz Eliezer in Simon Pei clarifies it to tell you that he felt that despite a terminal situation, despite great pain, if the person was alive, had a heartbeat, he absolutely felt that there was no room for withholding or withdrawing any resuscitation. And he actually goes one step further. In response to the story of the handmaiden of Rebbe and to the words of the Ran, he points out, I'm not impressed. Why am I not impressed? I don't see this halacha anywhere in the Rambam or in the Shulchan Aruch. It never made it to any of the codes of law. It therefore was felt not to be so significant. So therefore he maintains even prayer that a person should die was off limits to a halachic minded person. This obviously represents the most extreme view possible on these issues. Below him is Rabbi Bleich. Rabbi Bleich also has a fairly strict approach. He differs from the Tzitz Eliezer in two significant respects. Number one, he accepts the Ran, and he accepts the authority of Rebbe's handmaiden, and sees no contradiction to being able to pray for the demise of an individual, despite the fact that you must make every effort to keep them alive. We will see others do not share that sentiment, but you can look at his words on the page themselves. He felt that there is no contradiction between fulfilling one's obligation while at the same time hoping to relieve themselves of the responsibility. In terms of the Rama who appears in terminal situations to be giving license to withdrawal of certain impediments to death, he does not give the very abstract metaphysical interpretation of the Tzitz Eliezer. However, he emphasizes that the Rama's statements are limited solely to the situation of a gosis. A gosis is a technical halachic term that has, according to Rabbi Bleich, a very, very limited specific translation, specific definition. For one, and here's where he really limits the definition, a gosis is only an individual who will be dying within 3 days and will live for at most 3 days, despite all of modern medicine's efforts to keep him alive. So it has to be somebody who, despite all the efforts of medicine, nevertheless will be dying in 3 days. This obviously limits the application of the Ramaz Heterim greatly. Rabbi Bleich also sees no room to ever differentiate between ordinary and extraordinary efforts in resuscitation. To him, Hashem gave us, just as he gave us food for nourishment and drink for hydration, he gave us the ability and the different modalities with which to make medication, with which to make intubation tubes, with which to make catheters. It's all part of God's gift to mankind that are at his disposal and with which he is bidden to use in his efforts to fight disease. Therefore, he would never recognize splitting and saying extraordinary measures are out, just do the ordinary measures. He further emphasizes that in our case of an individual who's not in pain, there is no question that everything must be done to sustain that patient, and there is no notion of futility and uselessness to life. Every moment of life for every being who is alive in whatever state they are in is of value. We have no right to ever qualify that and deem somebody not worthy of rescue. And finally, just one more statement that we'll come back to. Interestingly enough, when Rabbi Bleich discusses a patient who is in severe pain, he recognizes that that will be the one exception. He admits, based on an analysis that we may get to, that it is true that al-pi halacha, nobody is bidden to be forced to live life that is just one of severe pain. And that under conditions of intractable pain, that would be the sole exception to where everything must be done. So why is it that Rabbi Bleich remains on the page of those who do not allow flexibility? It is because Rabbi Bleich maintains that there is no such condition really encountered, or there is no such condition that should be encountered in today's modern society and modern medicine. And he cites many articles that will demonstrate by experts that 99% of cases of intractable pain can be managed without the need to recourse to euthanasia. We'll come back to that point in a moment. If you turn the page, we get to the other group of poskim. This group seems to allow for much more flexibility. Spearheading this group are Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Arba. They too are focused on the very same sources that we were analyzing the previous views. Rav Moshe says, there's a real contradiction here. How could the Ramah say, I can remove impediments to death? How could it be, at the same time as where I see that I'm allowed to be over on any avera, I could do almost anything in order to save every moment of life? It must be that the situation that Ramah is talking about, a goses, is one that is absolutely replete with pain. It is a painful experience to be a goses, even if the doctors tell you otherwise, and even if to human perception it seems as though the person is not in pain. That is the way Rav Moshe explains the steer. That is how he reconciles this contradiction. Because a person who is terminal and in the end of his life is in severe pain, that is why we are allowed in a non-active way, in a passive way, to withhold life-saving measures. He certainly accepts the Ran and the handmaiden of Rebbe's conclusions that one could pray for the death of a patient in that situation, but he takes it a step further based on the analysis of that other source, and he says without a doubt that a person who is in a terminal condition, in severe pain, one need not do full resuscitative measures. He does add, however, that he will always say that oxygen is appropriate, hydration is appropriate, and nutrition. Because those are things that, if taken away, will only contribute to the pain. Shlomo Zalman Orbach has a very similar approach. He differs mainly in understanding the need for oxygen and hydration and nutrition as being natural. This was the thing that the Rabbi Bleich objected to, this type of chiluk, this type of distinction, that one can never withhold natural entities such as food and hydration. But otherwise, he too recognizes that there are situations where the pain is so unbearable that, within the view of the Ramah, one can withhold life-saving measures if all they will do is prolong a person's agony. Neither Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman explicitly come out and say that they can apply the same reasoning to the patient in a persistent vegetative state. In fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein, as you'll see in the handout, makes a point just towards the opposite conclusion. He says all he is talking about are patients that are in situations of great pain, such as a gosace, but a person who is alive in a non-terminal condition, who is not considered in pain, it seems that he would, at first glance, promote full resuscitative measures. Of course, that gets somewhat complicated when one starts to analyze the details. For example, the act of intubation, the act of CPR, is itself a painful experience. And it could be that such painful experiences are inappropriate in a terminal case. Finally, the last two views, which go to the other end of the spectrum, the most relatively flexible views, are that of Rav Schechter Shlita and Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. Rav Schechter cites Rav Shlomo Zalman's opinion and Rav Moshe's opinion, and he focuses more on a different angle to the question. It is a well-known fact that in Jewish law, and here's one of the great distinctions between a secular approach to many ethical issues and a halachic approach. Whereas, if you ask most bioethicists, one of the most fundamentally significant principles is the principle of autonomy. It is one of the strongest guiding principles for decision making in contemporary bioethics. A person has a right to decide what happens with their body. It is well known that that is not true in halacha. There are many, many sources that substantiate that point. You could find it in the handout. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through them. But Rav Schechter asks a question, and he says, it's true, I agree, that we certainly hold that a person does not have total autonomy, according to halacha, to do with their body as they please. We're sort of shomrim, we're watching over, we're borrowing a gift from God. We don't have a right to abuse it. However, do we have no say whatsoever? And Rav Schechter will demonstrate through certain sources and a comparison to risk-taking decisions that, in fact, we do have a say. There are certain areas of halacha, certain situations, gray areas of decision making, where the decision is in the hands of the cholah. One of those areas is an issue of deciding between suffering and death. So Schechter concludes that, along the lines of Rav Moshe Feinstein or Shlomo Zalman, when a person is faced with the choice of intractable pain and allowing for death, he certainly has the right to choose to not have any of the treatments done. And because his reasoning is along the lines of personal choice, it also opens up Rav Schechter to the possibility of a new flexibility not formally mentioned explicitly by Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman, and that is, it could be that even in cases of not unretractable pain, but even in cases of persistent vegetative state, for example, or states where a person would choose, or in the words of Rav Schechter, 99 out of 100 people would choose not to be in such a state, the conclusion might be that a person has a right to choose not to be in that state, or that we have the right to assume that that person would choose not to be in that state. Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg is explicit in this regard. And he is the last source on the bottom page, on the left corner. And he says, again, reacting to the contradiction between the Ramah's allowance for the removal of impediments to death and the known psak of the Shulchan Aruch that we have to do everything possible, even for a moment of life, he says the following. Nira Shedin Hatzala, the law of saving, the requirement to save people, lo ne'emar el b'makom shenene hanitzol b'harachas yamam. It only has application where the person who is being saved will enjoy the longer life. V'tov lo she'arichu yamav, and it is good for him that his life should be prolonged. That's when we are obligated to prolong his life, to save him, and we are allowed to be mechalel Shabbos. But when it's better that he should be not alive, machmas yisurim, because of pain, or she'ein lo shum to'elis b'chayim, there is no point to his life, she'ein lo das kval, he has no ability, no cognitive ability, vazeh ein din hatzalah. That is the most dramatic conclusion. In those cases, he concludes, there is no din that we are required to save that person. So far, I've been keeping and purposely keeping the discussion in my goal to get through all the shitos in a very general sense. I haven't gotten into some of the specifics. There are many details and specifics involved in all of these different opinions. Perhaps they'll come out in the question session. But I want to conclude this talk by just making the following two statements. If you look on page 9, what we've seen in going through these various opinions is that there is, even within Orthodox Judaism, a variety of thought and conclusion as to how to handle these situations. I think for a person who is a halakhic-minded person, the single most important lesson to draw out of this is that whatever the case may be, especially when you hear stories about slow codes and injections into mattresses, that a person do what they can to maintain control over their own destiny. And as an Orthodox person, to assure that there will be halakhic input into decisions made at the end of life. Therefore, a DNR per se is not a good idea. It completely restricts the person, except under specific situations where it could be appropriate, but a well-in-advance DNR is clearly not an option. Something like a living will also attempts to predict the person's feelings and sentiments well in advance, hopefully, of any situation, and therefore might not reflect what the person feels at the time they really encounter the situation. So it also seems to be very a limiting approach. And therefore, a healthcare proxy, and one specifically that has the halakhic concerns in mind, seems to be the best option. And for those interested, I have copies of the two halachic-minded healthcare proxies here, one from the Aguda, one from the RCA and the OU. And we could talk about that more in depth if there are any questions about any of the details. As a final word, I want to just quote from Rav Shlomo Zalman. At the end, you could see when you read Rav Shlomo Zalman's comments on these issues, you could sense the pain he has as he discusses them. So he ends off his discussion, Hashem Hatov Yishmerenu Mikol Ra, V'Yikuyam Banu V'Asirosi Komachla Mikirbecha, V'Yizakenu La'Avdo B'Simcha U'Betov Lev Kol Hayamim. Are there any questions?
Just before we open up the floor to questions, I'd like to say thank you very much to Rabbi Appel. And we'd like to let you guys know that there's going to be an exciting panel about Aliyah, hosted by the Israel Club after we're done in this room. So please, any questions?
In practice, what should a medical professional do when encountering a patient with a DNR? And it doesn't matter whether or not the patient is Jewish.
I'm assuming by your question you mean if it's a patient who you feel halachically it's inappropriate to have the DNR. That is a question that in Nishmas Avram he discusses. He brings forward the opinion of Rav Yashov, the Tzitz Eliezer, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Arbach. Without getting into any of the details, their bottom line is that you are not required to give up your license or your entire professional life and your job and your parnasa because of the chiyuv of lo tamod adam riach. It has, if you're interested, I'd be happy to go into the details with you. It is related to the analysis of how much a person has to give up monetarily to not be over on a lav, right? So usually for a lav, it's your entire income. But there's a discussion amongst the later commentators, the Achronim, does that mean all lavim or only a lav sheyesh bo masa? Lo tamar adam reyecha is a passive lav, which opens the door for not needing to give up your entire livelihood in order not to be over on it. So although we're acknowledging that you're not doing the chiyuv of latamal adam reyecha, because of the ramifications, you can passively stay out of it. Some of the poskim threw in the fact that depending on the details of the case and how inappropriate it is, there are also different degrees of leeway.
Okay, we're going to take two more questions, and then we're going to be moving over to 535, which is across the hall. There's going to be refreshments there, and Dr. Apple will be able to answer more specific questions. Aaron.
What does the research say as far as someone in a persistent vegetative state and as far as feeling pain?
Nobody knows. I'll give you the bottom line answer is there's a lot of speculation. There was recently a study done with a new technique of imaging of the brain that suggested that they are aware of a lot more than anyone formerly gave them credit for. However, it is a very early to draw any conclusions on that study, and it's been criticized for one, not really necessarily looking at true persistent vegetative state. The criteria are very strict for getting to that point, and that they were looking at earlier levels of neurological issues that are not quite the full persistent vegetative state. And therefore, it doesn't reflect the majority of patients. But the general consensus is that they do not necessarily feel any pain.
Just a quick follow-up. If the consensus is that they're not feeling any pain, then in the case of somebody in a persistent vegetative state, withholding nutrition and hydration that should not have any effect on increasing pain for them?
Assuming they don't feel pain, that would be correct. 100%. You would run into the problem, depending on which approach you were following. Rav Shlomo Zalman always considers food and hydration natural entities that can never be withheld. You're right, Rav Moshe might assume in that sense, if he's going to not approach it as Rav Shlomo Zalman did, as a natural necessity, but purely a painful issue, that ein hachinami, that would not be a consideration under those conditions. I should add, you know, that sometimes there is literature that reports that hydration and certain forms of nutrition can actually cause more pain towards the end of life in certain situations. So it's, you know, and I should have said this caveat from the beginning. I was talking throughout the entire discussion in klalim, in generalities. That's mainly because I was trying to get a lot of information in the allotted or more than the allotted time. But truthfully, every case is absolutely specific, and one cannot paskin certainly or even draw major conclusions from generalities.
In the stroke and traumatic brain injury literature, there are people who want to say there are at least five different states of the what we call vegetative state, including what is a locked-in state.
Right.
Because you cannot respond, but you are aware, you have cortical activity, EEG-wise, brain flow, and other demonstrations through other modalities. So it's very hard to say.
Right, that's
the patient does not have the potential to respond except the brain is capable of acting out on it.
Right. That's why the bottom line was that there is no certainty on that issue whatsoever.
Just a quick question. This is a case that I experienced with unfortunately, a 5 month old who had a hypoxic encephalopathy. And there was no DNR, there's no DNI. And the parents of the child worked in the hospital. And a code occurred, and the parents were brought up, the father was brought up, and he tended to ask the parents, should I continue resuscitating at the time? And the parents said, stop. He had multiple seizures, this is the last one, and he's become deaf. Halakhically, can one stop CPR in the middle of code? And in another question, just to add on to that, if a patient comes in with defib or asystole, whereas you know asystole, the chances of recovering are almost nil, whereas defib, you have a chance, can you stop CPR?
Right. I don't think that differentiating between whether you should start at all or whether you should not start at all, or if you're in the middle stopping, that such a differentiation is made halachic. In other words, if there is no additional chiv on a person to continue because they started, then there would have been to start in the first place. So that if it's a situation where full resuscitation was appropriate or obligatory, then that remains the state once you've started. If to begin with it was not, then that should remain the state, depending, unless you've made headway and the patient's status has changed. Otherwise, I don't think that halakhically we would begin to say, if that's the intent of your question, that because you started it, does that give you more of an obligation to continue? It could be viewed as, you know, just almost the opposite, that once you've made an effort, there is a point where a reasonable effort has been made, and if you're not getting anywhere, then all you're doing is prolonging the suffering, and there might be a halachic obligation to stop, and not more of a halachic obligation to continue. Usually resuscitation is where some of the most painful experiences occur, in my experience.
Dr. Apple, according to Razam and Femizikin, those who might follow him, who's to decide when a life is or is not victorious?
So he qualified the statement as one where the patient has no doubts. To me, he was talking about the most extreme case over there, a persistent vegetative state, possibly, one where there is no cognitive ability. I don't think anybody, right, even this most flexible view, would ever start making qualifications on the toelis of anybody's life. That is a line that could easily be taken out of context and misunderstood. So I'm glad you gave us the opportunity to clarify. In no way would I imagine any halachic decider making drawing such a conclusion that we can begin to qualify people's lives as being of value compared to others. What he was talking about was that a situation in the most extreme, probably a persistent vegetative state, where the person has no ability to do anything whatsoever, and therefore, in that sense, there is no to'elus for that individual to continue. But nothing obviously relating to their potential intelligence or anything of that nature. Chas v'shalom.
In my practice, we make some very clear distinction between advanced electives, withholding, withdrawing, versus a do not resuscitate order. And even halakhically, I'm wondering, at the time of resuscitation, you're usually dealing with, let's assume, someone who's asystolic. Is not halakha different for someone who's asystolic versus the issues of advanced directives?
That's
mainly what I think you focus on.
When you say asystolic, do you mean that they're no longer alive?
Well, you someone's fallen cold, and you arrive to the bedside, and the patient is asystolic.
Right.
That's a lot of right. You resuscitate that.
Okay, now I understand your question. If the patient is such that medical experts determine asystolic, for those who don't understand the medical terminology, means that his heart is not beating. He is in full cardiac arrest without any heartbeat whatsoever. A patient whose heart is not beating and they are not breathing, usually by all definitions, is no longer alive. However, I myself have experienced situations where for whatever reason, similar to the case I opened up with, a patient can get to such a state where they become bradycardic, which means their heart rate slows, and then it comes to the point where, as far as you know, they are asystolic. And yet, if you're doing CPR and you jump right in, they are resuscitatable. Until a patient is irreversibly dead, if resuscitation is appropriate according to all the other criteria, meaning we're not just prolonging suffering, etc., then absolutely, halachically, you're obligated to do whatever you can do. Lo tamo d'adam reyach. 100%. Right? You have to know the situation. If the person's been asystolic for 10 minutes, it's another ballgame. Chas v'shalom. Lo aleinu. But if it's a witnessed arrest, right, the circumstances obviously are very important. I've been there, right? A witnessed arrest, total asystole, is recoverable within a minute or two. Not much more than that. Not much more.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Appel. And we have a really good speech. I'd like to ask you.
Hello. Just a clarification. The program for the Aliyah began across the hall. We're going to stay here if people have any questions. They can answer the back up or the back up. Thank you so much for coming.